there are a lot of different potential technologies that fit under this umbrella that we call climate engineering or geoengineering. And so on the one hand, we have so-called carbon dioxide removal responses. Some folks call these negative emissions technologies. And these are technologies that might one day suck large amounts of carbon or other greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and hold these gases in storage or put them to some beneficial use. And on the other hand, we have so-called solar radiation management technologies, which are a bucket of possible technologies that would reflect some amount of incoming sunlight back into space before it can warm the atmosphere. So the conversation about carbon dioxide removal technologies has picked up some steam and is gaining some policy traction for reasons that we can talk about. But on the solar radiation management side, there's still a lot of trepidation. And that trepidation is real and understandable. And at the same time, these are technologies that really do need to be on at least a few people's radar. So when we're talking about solar radiation management technologies, there are a number of different proposals on the table at the moment. And what I should make clear is that these really are chalkboard proposals. They haven't really gone beyond the level of modeling or some people looking at what they call natural analogs, so other examples of this sort of thing already in existence in the world that we can learn from. So let me give you a couple of examples so you know what we're talking about. If you're looking to reflect sunlight back into space, then what you need to do is to increase what's called the albedo, or the reflectivity of the planet, at some level from ground level all the way up into the upper atmosphere. And so at ground level, one could imagine, for instance, genetically engineering crops so that their leaves are more reflective, or making large surfaces white to reflect incoming sunlight back into space. Stephen Chu, who was Energy Secretary under Obama, often talked about white roofs as a way to suppress heat island effect. And at large enough a scale, that might actually change climate. Now, it would be hard to do that at large enough a scale to actually make a difference. And so the leading proposals are actually further up in the atmosphere, proposals to try and reflect sunlight. And the two proposals that most folks talk about are what's called marine cloud brightening. And so this idea would be to spray salt water up into the cloud layer so that it nucleates the formation of new or whiter clouds over a particular region. And at large enough a scale, this could change regional climatic patterns and weather patterns. And then the leading proposal, in the sense that this is the one that's received most attention, is something called stratospheric aerosol injection. And so the idea here would be to mimic what happens when you get large-scale volcanic eruptions, which spew sulfur and other particles up into the atmosphere. Sulfur particles are reflective. And so when these sulfur particles migrate into the stratosphere, one of the upper layers of the atmosphere, then they reflect sunlight. There was an eruption in the Philippines, Mount Pinatubo, in 1991, and it put something like 5 teragrams of sulfur up into the upper atmosphere. And what we saw was a cooling of global average temperatures by something like 0.5 degrees Celsius over about 18 months or so before the sulfur particles rained back down to Earth. And so one could imagine trying to artificially generate the same sort of impact by taking sulfur particles, putting them in jet aircraft or using some other delivery system and shooting these sulfur particles into the upper atmosphere. Yeah, so the question is, how close are we to implementing stratospheric aerosol injection or some of these other technologies? Well, if the planet got desperate, that is, you got a large enough group of policymakers and a large enough section of the public saying, let's just do something, you know, the climate situation is getting desperate. One could imagine that you could start launching sulfate particles into the upper atmosphere within just a handful of years. Right, this is not a devastatingly difficult technology to imagine or to engineer. There are puzzles here, but they're puzzles that could probably quite easily be overcome. Now, if you wanted to do this safely, and if you wanted to do this with a reasonable chance of understanding what the impacts were, then we're looking at a research program that would last at least a couple of decades. Right, so we're at least a couple of decades away from safe, reasoned deployment of any technology of that type and scale. Yes, when it comes to carbon dioxide removal, very quickly we're bleeding into what's traditionally called mitigation. Yeah, so in the climate world, to mitigate is to either keep greenhouse gases from entering the atmosphere or to augment sinks, that is, places in the planetary system that draw carbon down from the atmosphere. Right, and so by one measure, just planting a bunch of trees is a carbon dioxide removal strategy. Now, already we're talking about that in the international climate negotiations, and we know that one way to bring carbon out of the atmosphere is to plant forests. So that's where these kind of categories start to bleed together a little bit. Beyond forests, there are lots of other potential biological pathways to keeping greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere or drawing them down from the atmosphere. Some folks have talked about, for instance, dropping iron filings into iron-scarce regions of the ocean. If one did that, then you could cause potentially blooms of small microscopic organisms called phytoplankton. And as those phytoplankton grew, they would draw carbon out of the atmosphere. And as a portion of those phytoplankton died and sank down to the ocean's surface or down to the ocean's floor, then they would take some of that stored carbon down with them, is the theory. As well as these so-called biological pathways, there are also so-called chemical pathways to carbon dioxide removal. And so ultimately, if you want to take carbon in the atmosphere and keep it in long-term storage, you want to turn it into rocks, right? That's the carbon cycle. So calcium carbonate and other rocks that hold carbon in storage in the long term over processes that take thousands or tens of thousands of years. There might be ways to speed those processes up. And so folks are looking at what they call artificial weathering, that is taking these rocks and grinding them up and spreading them around so that they more quickly take carbon out of the atmosphere. The other leading proposal on this chemical side is something called direct air capture. So using a membrane and hopefully relatively small amounts of energy to take carbon dioxide directly out of the open atmosphere, where it's present at about 400 parts per million. We can do this out of smokestacks at the moment, and through the process of carbon capture and storage, we know that we can take stuff, you know, take carbon dioxide out of flue gas when it's combusted from, say, a coal-fired power plant, and you can bury some of that carbon under the ground. But at the moment, it's a nascent technological system, and there are still lots of problems with it, including cost. Well, there's one technological system that I haven't talked about yet, which I should mention, when it comes to carbon dioxide removal, and this is now on the table because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in their most recent assessment report, privileged this technological option in the models that they were relying on. And this is a technological option called Bioenergy with Carbon Capture and Storage, BECCS, B-E-C-C-S. Now, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage would work in the following way. You'd grow biomass, so this might be trees, or it might be switchgrass, or it might be the husks taken from corn or whatever, and then you'd turn that biomass into either liquid fuel or burn it directly. That's the first step. The second step would then be to capture the carbon dioxide that comes out of that combustion. That's the carbon capture piece. And then the last step is to store it somewhere. All right, so bioenergy with carbon capture and storage or sequestration. Now, in the world, we have all of the different pieces of that. We know how to make bioenergy. We know how to capture carbon out of flue gas. We know basically what it means to store the stuff. In the most recent assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, there were 200-odd different model runs, that is, computer simulations, that forecast keeping the world beneath no more than 2 degrees of warming above pre-industrial averages. This is the internationally agreed target that the international community is shooting for, no more than 2 degrees of warming. Out of those 200-odd runs, more than 180 of them required large-scale use of carbon dioxide removal technologies by mid-century. And the carbon dioxide removal strategy that was introduced into the models was this bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. So we know that we have all the different components of a large-scale bioenergy with carbon capture and storage system. That's a possibility, a technological possibility. But at the scales that are being considered in the models that incorporate this technology, it would be just a staggering human undertaking and a staggering human intervention in natural systems. We're talking potentially, if these systems were to be developed, about trying to take down something like 10 gigatons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year by mid-century. And at that scale, calculations suggest you'd need something like 2/3 of the landmass of India planted in biomass just directed towards this particular technological pathway. And just think about all the implications of that, the water use implications, the food versus fuel type conversations that we had around ethanol just a handful of years ago. And just think about the challenges with negotiating the land use and all of the potential conflicts and so forth that emerge from an intervention in Earth systems at that scale.